From the Moan Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, we say farewell to Penny Marshall. The actress and director has died at the age of 75. Then Simon Helberg never watched It's a Wonderful Life growing up. Now he plays George Bailey, the lead in a stage adaptation of the holiday classic.
Everyone says, oh my gosh, you're going to be held up to this iconic portrayal and this story that's ingrained in everybody's DNA. And that is true, but I feel a little bit of liberation because it came in a little bit just with fresh eyes, I think.
And we'll hear about the musical and spiritual legacy of Alice Coltrane, all that coming up on The Frame.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Warner Brothers Pictures' Crazy Rich Asians. National Board of Review winner for Best Ensemble, Crazy Rich Asians has moved audiences and critics alike. Now nominated for 2 Golden Globes. For your consideration in all categories, including Best Picture.
Welcome to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Penny Marshall, who died Monday night at the age of 75, did not mince words. Here's the actress and director in an interview for the Academy of Television Arts and Sciences when asked when she was born.
I was born in the Bronx, New York.
On
New
what,
York City.
What date?
On your business, sorry.
That was just the start of a multi-hour interview that is archived with the TV Academy. Like her Happy Days co-star Ron Howard, Penny Marshall was one of the very few people to move from acting in a sitcom to directing studio features. Her early TV roles included the series Odd Couple, whose writers included her brother, Gary Marshall. But Penny Marshall cemented her place in TV history as Laverne DeFazio in the Happy Days spinoff, Laverne and Shirley, which debuted in 1976. Laverne was the lovable, loudmouthed, somewhat klutzy half of the buddy sitcom, which co-starred Cindy Williams.
Society gentlemen would only go out with you for one reason. To have a good time, a few laughs, and a little vodeo-do-do.
Oh, I don't vodeo-do-do.
You vodeo-do-do.
I don't vodeo-do-do.
You vodeo.
The show arrived when TV had very little interest in working-class, ordinary women, and yet it became the most popular series on the air for several seasons.
I just was doing it to save myself from bad dialogue or something. But I knew I could do, I was very brave and fearless. And I was a tomboy. I used to hang my, they all reported to my mother. She's on the fire escape. You know, she's hanging on the roof. You know, so I was fearless.
That fearlessness no doubt extended to her directing. In the late 80s, she directed television series here and there, but then she moved to directing feature films, and that was pretty rare for women back then. Her first feature was the 1986 Whoopi Goldberg comedy Jumpin' Jack Flash, and she got the job when the original director was fired in the middle of production.
I have a good telephone book. So I called in Carol Kane, John Lovitz, Phil Hartman. I called Lorne, I need John and Phil. And Lynn Marie, who's Cindy's friend, so they could improvise. So, and my brother, my daughter, you, Jim Belushi, you know, I have a good friend. And I'm like, okay, let's bring this. And some were cast, so I didn't know. So some people were cast, but I had a phone book that I cast in, you know, my other people, and brought in people who did television. And Matt Leonetti, I was hired on a Friday and shot Monday. I didn't know what pre-production was. I just thought I'm cutting a class. So didn't know anything.
Jumpin' Jack Flash was not a hit. Her second movie was and landed Penny Marshall in the record books. Big starred Tom Hanks as a boy named Josh, who is magically put in the body of a man after a wish comes true.
Look, I know I don't look like myself, okay? But something really strange happened, and I'm really scared. I need you to help me, my best friend! I can prove it to you! Oh! The space goes down, down, baby, down, down the roller coaster. Sweet, sweet, baby, sweet, sweet, don't let me go. Shimmy, shimmy, cocoa pop, shimmy, shimmy, rock. Shimmy, shimmy, cocoa pop, shimmy, shimmy, rock. I met a girlfriend, a Triscuit. She said a Triscuit, a biscuit, ice cream, soda, pop, no, I'll stop. Who's your leader? Walking down the street, 10 times a week. I met it, I said it. Oh, my mama's credit. I'm cool. I'm hot. Suck you in the stomach 3 more times.
Josh?
Big took in more than $100 million in ticket sales in domestic theaters in 1988, and with that, Penny Marshall became the first female director to surpass that milestone. Of course, very few women were given directing jobs then, but she did it again with her movie A League of Their Own. That film had a sort of narrative that Marshall could relate to, being a woman making it in a male-dominated field. It was about an all-women's baseball team headed by a patronizing coach played by Tom Hanks.
Are you crying? Are you crying? There's no crying. There's no crying in baseball.
Why don't you leave her alone, Jimmy?
Oh, you zip it, Doris. Rogers Hornsby was my manager, and he called me a talking pile of pig. And that was when my parents drove all the way down from Michigan to see me play the game. And did I cry?
No.
No. No. And you know why?
No.
Because there's no crying in baseball. There's no crying in baseball.
The film also starred Rosie O'Donnell, Madonna, and Gina Davis, who had this reflection on A League of Their Own.
In the press, they were saying, this changes everything. Now there's going to be so many female sports movies. This proves once and for all that women's sports movies can be huge successes. And there were none. The ratio of male to female characters has been exactly the same since 1946. So all the times people have predicted, now this changes everything. It hasn't happened. And the more awareness we bring, that's great, but we have to move the needle. We have to make a very, very conscious effort to move the needle.
For her part, Penny Marshall did move the needle for women directors, but she didn't take herself that seriously. As in this video where Fred Armisen impersonates Penny in an ad for her memoir, My Mother Was Nuts.
Hello, I'm Penny Marshall. This is my new book, My Mother Was Nuts. Memoir by Penny Marshall, that's me. My Mother Was Nuts. Got some good stories in it. The book's coming out September 18th. Are we gonna have a phone number here? A link to what?
Amazon. You gotta go to the Amazon to get a book?
Buy it. I'm just gonna pick out a few words from the book. Shut up, Jim Brooks.
This is just two pages I open up to.
Oh, there's some good parts in here. I'm not gonna read them out loud, but they're juicy.
And Penny Marshall was also a huge basketball fan. You've probably seen her courtside for Lakers and Clippers games. And when she died, she was finishing a documentary about former NBA superstar and North Korean diplomat Dennis Rodman. The film is scheduled for release next year. Penny Marshall was 75 years old. Coming up, 'tis the season for It's a Wonderful Life. Not the movie, but the live radio play. A lot of families have a favorite holiday movie that they rewatch every year. For some, it's A Christmas Story. For others, it could be a more recent film like Elf. But there's one film that's on a lot of people's lists. It's A Wonderful Life. But Big Bang Theory actor Simon Helberg didn't watch It's a Wonderful Life growing up. In fact, he didn't see the movie for the first time until about 15 years ago. But now he's living out the film six times a week at the Pasadena Playhouse. Helberg is starring in It's a Wonderful Life, a live radio play. It's stage director Cameron Watson's take on the 1946 movie, directed by Frank Capra. Actors read the story like an old-fashioned radio drama, complete with 1940s attire, live sound effects, and corny radio jingles. Helberg is currently wrapping up the 12th and final season of The Big Bang Theory. And when I spoke with him, I asked about balancing his time between two very different productions.
Well, that was sort of what was beautifully teed up about this, I guess, was, you know, I got a call from Cameron and he said, hey, you know, in a couple of weeks, we're starting rehearsals. We'll have about a week of rehearsal. You'll get to hold the script in your hand. We'll run for 2 weeks. So scheduling wise, it was perfect. And, you know, yeah, it can be very tricky with theater, especially the rehearsal process, the time it takes to learn lines, all of that is kind of hard to squeeze in, because you want to be up and running usually for a couple months, and if, when you can't really rehearse for a month, run for a couple months, shoot a show or shoot a film or anything like that. So this was just, the downside was we had about 5 or 6 days of rehearsal, but
then that's the big paycheck. So
yeah, exactly. But then, flying by the seat of your pants, and I think my pants blew off at some point during it, but then there we were in front of a big house and one of the most beautiful theaters in the world, the State Theater, I hear, is what the Pasadena Playhouse actually is to California. It's 100 years old, and it was one of those. It was just one of those perfectly timed things, and I felt like, oh, hey, I get to bring more Christmas joy to people this year than a mall Santa. So that's kind of awesome.
I want to play a scene from the Frank Capra film, and then we'll talk about how it is adapted for radio and for the theater.
Mother.
Mother, what do you want?
Mother, this is George. I thought sure you'd remember me.
George who? If you're looking for a room, there's no vacancy.
So for the 12 people who don't know It's a Wonderful Life, the conceit is George Bailey says, what if I'd never been born?
Right.
And he goes to visit his mom, Ma Bailey,
right,
at a boarding house. And he's never been born, so she has no idea who he is.
Right.
And there is obviously a genius conceit to the story, but there's also something that if you watch the movie, you see Jimmy Stewart as he's realizing what has happened to the world without him, this kind of shock and surprise. So how do you go about in this production capturing what is a more or less visual story for radio? What were the conceits and what are the overcomes that you're facing?
Well, I have the luxury of ignorance and insulation with me not really being overly familiar with this movie. I've probably seen it twice. A Christmas Story for me was the big Christmas movie in my, or Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, or the Tom Hanks, canon, I guess. And he's kind of the Jimmy Stewart of
so post Waltons, but Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. Okay.
So if I had to do one of the movies I grew up with, I think it'd be very hard to get that music out of my head and that portrayal. This one, luckily, I don't really come in with that much baggage. I don't feel the pressure as much as everyone says, oh my gosh, you're going to be held up to this iconic, portrayal and this story that's ingrained in everybody's DNA. And that is true, but I feel a little bit of liberation because of my ignorance. And so I came in a little bit cocky. No, a little bit just with fresh eyes, I think.
And outside of your uncanny resemblance to Jimmy Stewart, one of the things that clearly...
I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah, well, it's funny you said that, because so many of the actors, all of the actors, have to do multiple voices.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering what that's like in terms of rehearsal, because you have 5 speaking actors, right?
Right.
All of whom are doing, I guess if you counted it, maybe a total about 50 different voices through the course of the show?
I can't count that high, but yes. Something like that. I think you're probably right. It's somewhere in there. And the funny thing is I don't do any. I just do
That's
one.
True.
And I, the other actors are so fantastic. They do just dozens of voices and little kids and the women playing old men and all of that. So it's just a lot of fun. I think it's visually, I hope, really entertaining too, which again, I've done real radio plays and the visual part is not the selling point. So this one actually does kind of both, I think. And there's a Christmas tree up there and you feel like you're kind of hanging out in a radio station, I think.
One of the weird things, and I don't know if anybody that you have talked to who have seen it, or maybe even while you're going through rehearsals, I found it really interesting to actually close my eyes. Not that there wasn't a lot to look at, and
now
actually listen to it as if I was like cozying up to the
radio.
I can
read between the lines. You were sleeping. That's what you're telling me.
I was saying I was closing my eyes just to listen and focus on the sound of the show.
How was it?
It was very interesting.
I wish I could do it.
It is a different experience because it does, if you kind of let yourself relax and imagine that you're sitting next to a radio,
yeah,
it becomes surprisingly more intimate, which seems counterintuitive,
yeah,
but it does. It feels like it's just for you, I guess, that you're not with an audience.
Yeah. You like to be alone. You did not want to be around strangers, and you didn't even want to be at the theater. You just wanted to be sleeping next to a radio.
Yeah.
You can do that. That's interesting. Because I have no perspective of what, you know, because there's this incredible Foley artist on stage.
For those who don't know, Foley artist makes sounds, door slams, like glass breaking, various things like that.
Yeah, Jeff Gardner is the name of the Foley artist, and he might be the hardest working man up there. He's just doing everything. You've got splashing sounds, slapping sounds, books, money, walk. He's got taps on. He's doing a million and one things. So it's pretty incredible to watch.
And while this is not a musical, there is a little bit of singing. How would you describe the products that are being pitched? And maybe you could sing a few bars from one of the commercials.
What are the products?
There's a hair product.
There is, yes, Bremel, the Swank hair product. There is Duck's Toilet Cake. And they're all sung to, in Christmas jingle form. So you've got the whole, you know, Duck's Toilet Cake is cleaning uptown. You know, you've got that whole thing.
I like that. We're talking with Simon Helberg about his radio version of It's a Wonderful Life. One thing that I think is really worth noting, I think a lot of people around this time of year are trying to figure out how to keep out-of-town visitors entertained, specifically in-laws.
Yes.
I'm speaking very personally here. And I really can't think of anything better, especially, you know, if your in-laws are in their 60s or 70s to do, than take them to a play like this. And I'm curious, you probably have in-laws.
Yep.
Have you brought them to the show? Do they know about It's a Wonderful Life? Is it going to be a unit to fill your holiday schedule?
You could stick them on a bus and just send them to Pasadena if you don't get along with them. You could join them. You could Uber. There are many ways to get your in-laws to the show. My in-laws came to the opening, and it's my father-in-law's favorite movie of all time. He showed it to me for the first time, probably about 15 years ago. And he swears by it as being, you know, one of, or maybe the greatest movie ever. And so you do see people singing along. People last night were, you know, yelling out lines before we, I don't encourage that. Actually not yelling. It might've just been someone hard of hearing saying the line louder than they realized. But there's children, you know, in the front, and people are crying, and, you know, it's just something that seems to really touch a lot of people. But yes, on the in-law front, it is. Why does it feel like this is just a movie for in-laws? I don't know. In-laws aren't just they're not like a breed of human. They're
true.
Just people that happen to be, you know, the parents of our husbands or wives. But yes, it does feel like this is the favorite movie of all in-laws. Is It's a Wonderful Life. If you did a survey, I guess
I think that's probably true. Yeah. And the other thing that's interesting is that even though I think the message of the play as of the film is every person makes a profound impact on the people around them, even if they don't always appreciate it. The other message is a little dated, which is like, don't be too ambitious. Just like stay home and don't dream. Just like take what comes your way and be happy with that.
Yeah.
It's a little
It
dusty.
Is weird. I feel like the two sides of that coin. It is. There is a cynical version. And we talked about it for a second when we were rehearsing. It was like, wait a minute, is the message, hey, don't dream too big, son, you know? I don't think that it actually is, because I think that it really is, you know, George Bailey appreciates what he has all the time around him. He's a dreamer, and he also simultaneously is appreciating his family and his friends and in the community. What he's grappling with is, if I don't achieve these things, these dreams that I've strived for, have I contributed enough? Have I made a difference in the world? But I think what he learns at the end of this is to appreciate what he has brought, not to be, you know, to appreciate himself and not to criticize so much his own, I guess, what he sees as shortcomings.
I think the other message is, if you have a large amount of cash, don't stick it in the middle of a newspaper.
With your idiot uncle.
Yeah. Keep closer tabs on it.
I think so too.
And It's a Wonderful Life is playing through?
Through the 23rd, December 23rd.
So bring your in-laws. If you don't have in-laws, bring somebody else's in-laws.
Exactly. I think you can go online on Craigslist and get some in-laws to take with you.
Simon, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, the LA years of jazz musician Alice Coltrane.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Warner Brothers Pictures' Crazy Rich Asians, National Board of Review winner for Best Ensemble. Crazy Rich Asians has moved audiences and critics alike. Now nominated for 2 Golden Globes for your consideration in all categories, including Best Picture.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. In the late 1970s, jazz musician Alice Coltrane recorded 3 albums in Los Angeles for Warner Brothers Records. She had moved here following the death in 1967 of her husband, the saxophone legend John Coltrane. Those LA albums would be her last commercial recordings for more than 25 years, while Coltrane pursued a more spiritual path that would eventually lead her to the creation of an ashram near Malibu. This year's reissue of the lost Warner Brothers albums further spotlight Alice Coltrane as her music transitioned from the secular to the sacred. The Frame contributor Stephen Cuevas has our story.
By the time the young Alice MacLeod met her future husband, John Coltrane, in 1963, the classically trained musician with a background in gospel had already mastered bebop piano, and like John, she was looking to push jazz further. The couple soon married. They started a family and collaborated musically and spiritually until John's untimely death in 1967 at age 39.
He had that sort of overwhelming presence about him. Mm-hmm. And he never really had to talk or to instruct music. He really didn't have to do that.
Alice Coltrane talked about their brief but profound partnership in a rare 1981 interview on NPR's Piano Jazz.
Just being around him, listening to him express his ideas musically, it really is very inspirational, and it was to many people.
John also encouraged Alice to take up the harp, so he bought her one, and it was delivered to the family's home just weeks after John's death. Coltrane mastered it well enough to play it on her debut 1968 album called A Monastic Trio.
One can only wonder what dedication that takes to get up to the level that she did so fast while she's still in mourning.
Jazz critic Ashley Kahn wrote the liner notes for the new Alice Coltrane reissue.
The only way to explain this is cosmic intervention or really, really deep dedication.
The harp would become a fixture of Alice Coltrane's subsequent albums, including the 3 reissued this month, recorded for Warner Brothers in Los Angeles between 1975 and 1978. Just a couple years after relocating here from New Jersey, the harp and her piano sit where they have for decades, in the front room of the family home on a spacious semi-rural property in Woodland Hills.
That's the harp.
The harp, and I took the cover off for you. Because it just, we need to see it sometimes.
Daughter Sita Michelle Coltrane, a jazz vocalist, lives there now with her family.
And some mornings she would just play her harp. I've woken up to that harp right behind you.
She'd sometimes join her mom in the Warner Brothers studio too, playing hand percussion and chanting on several songs inspired by traditional Indian devotional songs called bhajans.
Even though it was Sanskrit, we could sing Jaya Raghupate Raghavara Sharam.
It goes all the way back to Africa.
Purusha Hickson also performed on Alice Coltrane's 3 albums for Warner Brothers.
Coming up into the church and then the association with the great John Coltrane. She brought all of that with her own deep connection with God. Even though she had some questionable musicians, speaking about myself, man.
The family's new life in sunny Southern California and Coltrane's blossoming spirituality is reflected on the song Om Supreme from the album Eternity, her first LA record for Warner. The album is driven by Coltrane's surging Wurlitzer organ that Ashley Kahn says enabled her to bend and stretch the notes.
Which made it sound very Eastern, the way that a sitar player loves to bend the string. She'd hit a certain note and then it would bend a little bit further, and that really becomes part of her sonic vocabulary.
Two more albums for Warner would follow in quick succession. They'd be looser and deeply rooted in gospel and Indian music, awash with exotic percussion and chanting choruses. Purusha Hickson told me the sessions were joyful.
You know, more like a village musician. When there's a celebration, everybody's just picking up a drum or claves or something, you know what I mean? Because you want to participate in the celebration.
By the end of Coltrane's Warner Brothers contract, there were new priorities. The founding of a 50-acre spiritual retreat near Malibu, a focus on devotional music, and the everyday demands of family life. Daughter Sita Michelle says Alice still did the occasional concert, but at select venues only. The jazz club days, they were over.
They were smoking then, the alcohol. This is now a person that's taken spiritual vows, devoting herself to God. Really wasn't a place where you shake your hips. It all fit with the lifestyle that she had chosen.
As Coltrane suggested to Marianne McPartland on NPR's Piano Jazz back in 1981, a new musical phase was taking shape.
What's the label now that you were?
All right, I am not contracted. And since the Warner Brothers contract finalized, that was in 1978, and I made the last double record album.
You're still writing and you're still composing.
Yes, definitely.
The music Alice Coltrane would create over the next 25 years was devoted almost entirely to her religious life. She'd released just one more commercial jazz album in her lifetime to wide acclaim in 2004. She died 3 years later at the age of 69. The Coltrane family sold the spiritual retreat near Malibu last year. For The Frame, I'm Stephen Cuevas.
And one postscript, the former Coltrane ashram was destroyed in the recent Woolsey fire. That's all we have for today. I'm John Horn. Thanks for listening. We'll be back here tomorrow.